fẹlẹ ko ye dormamu do kona mẹ dẹfẹlẹ ko kọ ina ye.
That's the distinct voice, the gravelly distinctive voice of the late Momo Wandel Suma of Guinea with Felenko Yefe. He is a singer, composer, and musician. He played tenor and alto sax, as well as banjo and mandolin. He started out playing at dance halls, but he was influenced by John Coltrane and Charlie Parker and Ornette Coleman, he said, and from the mid-80s began to blend traditional African music with jazz. Suma died in 2003 at the age of 77. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, February the 24th, 2015, and we're starting late. We had a glitch, but we are, dealing with it. We, of course, have been forced to move, and we are encountering little glitches as we go, but that will be fixed in no time. So thank you so much for your patience today. And we have as our guest the professor par excellence, Gerald Horn, the John and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, who is going to be framing for us the push and pull of shifting alliances among dominant powers and the emergence of new game-changing players and events that are challenging their established order. As you know, Dr. Horn is a familiar voice here on Lead Stories, and he delivers analyses that would escape everyone else. I think they are unique and they are quite penetrating and eye-opening. Dr. Horn's latest books are Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. It's a very important book, and in light of recent events with the U.S. opening up, attempting to open up a new relationship with Cuba, the book is particularly instructive. And, of course, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. We discussed both these books on this program. Thanks, Gerald, for being with us again today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And we're sorry we're starting a little late, but I explained to you what was going on. But let's start with where you think we ought to, given the range of topics that we might be discussing today.
Well, there's so much to choose from, sadly. But believe it or not, in terms of the chief and primary threat to international peace and security, if not the continuation of all humanity, I would have to say the Ukraine crisis. It's very disturbing. Sorry?
Agreed.
Yeah, it's very disturbing that leading officials of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which includes the United States of America, have talked in recent days quite openly about the possibility of a military conflict between NATO and Moscow. I mean, this could be a nuclear war, which the consequences of which are too ghoulish and ghastly to contemplate. We know that there has been a concerted effort by the French and the Germans, President Hollande of France and Chancellor Merkel of Germany, to meet with President Putin and their Ukrainian interlocutors to try to settle this crisis. There was an agreement coming out of Minsk, you may recall, just a few days ago in Belarus, but the fighting has seemingly continued. The rebels in eastern Ukraine, who are at least supported morally, if not materially, by Moscow, say that the cities over which they're fighting were not contemplated, were not considered in the Minsk agreement. But to step back for a second, I think that we have to recognize that this Ukraine crisis is driven by miscalculation by Washington. I think that the United States miscalculated what they saw as the weakness of Russia. They thought that they could push the borders of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, to the borders of Russia, which in many ways would be more dangerous than the Cold War when the North Atlantic Treaty Organization was just in Germany, that is to say in Berlin. And President Putin now feels, and the Russian people who marched in the thousands in Moscow just this past weekend feel, that the agenda of Washington is regime change. That is to say, to get rid of President Putin. And certainly the way he's been demonized in the U.S. press in recent days is quite imaginative. I even have students who are coming to me speaking of President Putin as the new Hitler and the new Stalin. And, of course, they got that kind of mishmash of nonsense from the U.S. press. I think that, A, the pressure on Russia is sort of a bank shot by Washington to deal with what President Obama has called the real challenge, which is China. That is to say, the pivot towards Asia. That is to say, President Obama's visit to India just a few weeks ago, which was a kind of Nixon to China visit, akin to what happened four decades ago when China was enlisted on behalf of the anti-Soviet crusade. Now the idea is to enlist India in the anti-China crusade, and given China's misdeeds in terms of dealing with India in recent decades, the very unfortunate war that took place in October 1962 as the Cuban Missile Crisis was unfolding, which, and by the way, was not coincidental that China chose to do that at that moment, given the fact that China still claims a good deal of Indian territory. China, of course, got to this position where it's considered to be the number one economy in the world, not necessarily by angelic means. A lot of it had to do with turning against Moscow during the Cold War and then becoming the recipient of massive amounts of foreign direct investment, creating this juggernaut, which now Washington is trying to bring to heel. Of course, it's not only India that's being enlisted in this China crusade, but Australia, which has very good trade relations with China, Japan, whose enmity with China goes back at least to the late 19th century, Vietnam, you may recall that China waged war in Vietnam after Deng Xiaoping, the paramount Chinese leader, came to Washington and Houston approximately 1979. And then, of course, there's Russia, and it was envisioned that Russia would enlist in this anti-Beijing crusade, but is not chosen to do so. And in fact, it's done the opposite. That's to say, warmed relations with Beijing, including one of the biggest deals, economic deals in human history. I'm talking about the natural gas deal of last year. You may recall that since President Xi Jinping came to power a year or two ago, that he and President Putin have met 13 times. Since then, as I've said before, I know couples who are dating who haven't met 13 times in the last two years. So Moscow hasn't played ball, and it's very difficult to go after China because it's the number one economy. Its population is four times that of the United States. And then you have corporations like Apple, which by some calculations is the largest corporation by market capitalization in world history, of over $700 billion, just earned $18 billion in the last quarter, believe it or not, mostly by selling iPhones, which are manufactured in China, to Chinese. And so it's very difficult to go after China with the same energy and brio that one goes after Russia. And so Russia it is. But it's very dangerous. And I might also say that the recent warming of relations with Cuba probably has something to do with this effort to effectuate regime change in Russia. That is to say that the NATO officials have been complaining about what they say are Russian incursions into the airspace of Sweden and the Baltic nations, which have recently joined NATO, and Britain as well. And then there has been consternation in Washington about allegations of Russian bombers in the Gulf of Mexico. And if there were to be, heaven forfend, a military confrontation between Washington and Moscow, certainly bad relations with Cuba would not be in Washington's interest, because Cuba would then, as in October 1962, perhaps have an interest in hosting Russians who go after the United States of America. And so what do? You improve relations with Cuba to hopefully stem that possibility. And at the same time, of course, you worsen relations with Venezuela and you worsen relations with other Latin American neighbors of Cuba. So in any case, this Moscow crisis has to be paid attention to because it's very dangerous.
Well, just last Friday, Britain's upper house of parliament, the House of Lords, issued a rather scathing report assessing, blaming what they said was the Britain's failure and the European Union's failure to read the crisis in Ukraine. They said there was a strong element of sleepwalking into the current crisis, with member states being taken by surprise by events in Ukraine. And there was a loss of collective analytical capacity that has weakened the member states' ability to read the political shifts in Russia and to offer an authoritative response. Now, what do you think it means, this report, by not only just criticizing Britain and the European Union this way, but also saying that because they sleepwalked into the crisis, they failed to read this very complex situation correctly, it thwarted the collective response to this, the exceptional nature of the crisis?
Well, a lot of that sleepwalking has to do, as the report suggested, with the leakage of specialists. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, you don't have as many students studying Russian. You don't have as many analysts going into Russian studies, and the same can be said for the United States of America. And that has led to a warping of analytic capacity. You see that in particular in the now infamous leaked phone calls between U.S. official Victoria Nuland, who, by the way, is the spouse of leading neoconservative Robert Kagan, who was intimidating the Ukrainian leadership, cursing out. I can't use her language on this family program that she said with regard to the European Union, but it wasn't very pleasant. And that reflected, of course, this rule the world mentality that still obtains in many quarters in Washington. But as I said, it was an overestimation of U.S. capacity and also an underestimation of Russian capacity. Part of this overreaching, which I think has become the hallmark of U.S. foreign policy, you saw that in particular with regard to these wars the United States has been losing in recent years, Iraq, Afghanistan, amongst others, is that because the left movement in this country is so weak and so feckless, it gives the right wing the misguided notion that it empowers the right wing to go off on its reckless sojourns, but it also misleads and misguides the right wing into thinking that other opposition forces worldwide are as weak and as feckless as the U.S. left is, which, of course, is not true. And so it's leading to one disaster after another. And you see this sort of strength of the right in the United States, and also the linked issue of the weakening of U.S. analytic capacity when it comes to Russia, and the controversy involving Stephen F. Cohen, the Russian studies scholar, formerly of NYU and Princeton, married to the heiress, Katrina VandenWavell, who, of course, is the editor and publisher of The Nation, the liberal Manhattan Weekly. She wanted to contribute in the name of her husband, Professor Cohen, hundreds of thousands of dollars to Russian studies in the United States of America, which would make up for a budget cut by Washington. But the conservatives are so upset with Stephen F. Cohen, she wanted the fellowships to be named in the name of her husband. It's like if I wanted to make a grant to PRN, and, you know, named, say, the Gerald Horn Radio Fellowships for budding journalists, and PRN says, hey, we'll take your money, but we don't want your name on it. Well, that's what happened. They say, we don't want his name on these fellowships because he doesn't have the correct position on Ukraine. Stephen F. Cohen, as you may recall, has been a stinging critic of U.S. policy towards Ukraine and has been branded unfairly as some sort of apologist for Putin. But the larger story is that it reflects, once again, the strength of the right wing in the United States to the extent that they'll turn down hundreds of thousands of dollars for scholarships and fellowships to study Russia, which at once helps to speak to the strength politically of the right wing, but also helps to speak to the lack of analytic depth in Russian studies when they're turning down money.
The odd thing here, Gerald, is that the House of Lords, the reason I pointed it out is that the House of Lords report that leveled these scathing observations about how Britain and the European Union had handled Ukraine come long after people like even Henry Kissinger had criticized the United States and the European Union and the West in general, saying that they were making a fatal mistake in this war. And Kissinger's comments came after those by Gorbachev, saying the same thing. And altogether, they said, essentially, that the key point here was that the way people, the main players involved, decided that the correct approach first was to isolate Russia and hopefully to confront it en masse and to revive the Cold War. These disparate groups, even Kissinger and we have Kissinger and Gorbachev and the House of Lords all agreeing that the West has screwed up here. So do you think this is likely to cause a rewiring of the diplomatic endeavors here with regard to Ukraine?
I tend to doubt it. The right wing in the United States is on a roll. They felt that they had a tremendous victory in the November 2014 midterm elections. They feel that the Obama administration is not up to par when it comes to military confrontation. They're about to shut down the government once again, and the outcry is not as tremendous as I thought it might be. You have Senator John McCain and Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who, by the way, is considering a presidential bid, who are talking about arming the Kiev government, which would be an escalation in Moscow's eyes. And it's even more dangerous in the sense that it's well known that both the Ukrainian military, the Kiev military, and the Kiev intelligence forces are riddled with Russian agents. I mean, they're totally penetrated. I'm surprised they haven't been overthrown yet. They're so, that is to say, the Kiev government, since they're so penetrated with Russian agents. And you started off by talking about Britain, and part of the problem with Britain right now are the May 2015 elections, where Prime Minister David Cameron, believe it or not, is lagging in the polls behind the Labour Party, and his support is hemorrhaging on the right because of the UK Independence Party, one of these right-wing anti-immigrant parties that have been sweeping through Europe of late. And this at once has made Cameron's policy, Tory party, more bellicose than usual. But on the, at the, by the same token, he's preoccupied with getting reelected, which means that he's been distracted. One of the many reasons why he hasn't been tagging along after Merkel and Hollande when they head off to Minsk to negotiate with Putin. So it's a very dangerous situation that's unfolding, and I would like to conclude with a ray of optimism, but I find myself hard-pressed to do so.
Well, does it get any better when we shift to Greece?
Well, as listeners know, the left-leaning Syriza party came to power in Greece just a few weeks ago. Greece is a small country, only 11 or 12 million people. It's been hammered by stringent financial requirements imposed by Germany and the European Union and the International Monetary Fund. The Syriza party negotiated and has gotten a four-month extension with regard to what, how it will or will not comply with austerity policies that have contributed heavily to intense unemployment, hunger, homelessness, and all manner of social ills, not to mention immigrant bashing and the rise of a neo-fascist party called Golden Dawn, which, by the way, has probable support in certain leading circles in these United States of America. So it's unclear if Syriza is going to be able to comply with all of its campaign promises with regard to fighting austerity, because the relationship of forces right now is not very positive for a small European country that has to face off against Germany and the European Union, not to mention a Washington brandishing a club in the background. But on the other hand, there is the possibility of a Syriza-like party, that is to say Podemos, we can, coming to power in Spain in upcoming elections. And then the Syriza party can always raise the specter of turning its back, or not necessarily turning its back, but going to try to effectuate a closer relationship with both Russia and China in order to countervail Germany and the European Union. And that's the sort of thing that's literally dangerous. That's the sort of thing that leads to political assassinations. But if Syriza is going to keep its campaign promises, it may be forced to do so. But in any case, we don't know right now. There's a four-month hiatus when Syriza is going to try to collect more tax money from Greek tycoons. As you know, Greek tycoons play a leading role in the maritime shipping industry, and also to crack down on corruption, which is not only rife in Greece, but rife globally, but particularly rife in Greece. So we'll know in 4 months whether or not Greece may be forced to move to Plan B, which is going to Moscow and Beijing.
Apart from this, this is, of course, a huge matter of money. We're talking several billions of euros on the line, and we're talking about what the Syriza government would have to do to, in the four-month period, to even begin to suggest that they have the wherewithal to come through the financial crisis that they are facing. The big word whenever we talk about the International Monetary Fund is privatization. What do you expect that Greece, this left-leaning party, would have to do when it confronts this matter of having to privatize things?
Well, already there's grumbling in the left wing of Syriza about what is perceived to be too many compromises by the finance ministry and the prime minister with regard to negotiations. For example, a leading campaign promise was raising the minimum wage, which, as you know, is also a key issue on this side of the Atlantic. apparently that promise will not be kept. There will, I think, be more food handouts, but as you know, that's like a Band-Aid on a bleeding sore. This kind of perception that Syriza is not keeping its campaign promises, it's also fueling not only internal conflict within Syriza itself, but also conflict on the left in general. As you probably know, the Greek Communist Party has stood down from supporting Syriza. Of course, it does not have as many voters in its ranks as Syriza. Syriza, of course, came out on top in the recent elections. But on the other hand, the conflict between Syriza and the Greek communists actually reflects a larger dynamic that may, if the left ever gets its act together in the United States, come to this side of the Atlantic. What I'm talking about is that Syriza at the top ranks is dominated by a number of professors. The same holds true for Podemos in Spain. Many of these professors were formerly part of the communist parties in those respective countries, whereas the communist party in Greece is heavily dominated by seafarers, that is to say, toilers in the maritime shipping industry, and dock workers. So it's a proletarians versus the professors kind of scenario. And as that kind of pithy phrase tends to suggest, there are kinds of cultural differences, perhaps status differences between these two forces that helps to exacerbate the ideological and political differences. And sadly enough, I'm sure that what I'm saying has not been lost on the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, which can play upon those kinds of conflicts and differences and tensions to their benefit, I'm afraid.
At the root here, too, is it's not just about a nation confronting monumental austerity that they have experienced in recent years, a shift in the political wind. It is also a kind of international test, is it not, of a capitalism versus something else. And the intent here is to have even this fledgling effort fail. Do you see any evidence that that is in fact at play right now?
Oh, sure. I mean, it reminds me of tiny Grenada. A country of 110,000 people in the Caribbean whose adult population could fit comfortably into Yankee Stadium, leaving many seats empty. And yet, when the New Jewel Movement came to power in the spring of 1979, it was seen as a mortal threat by the United States of America. And that was in the context, of course, of the Cold War, where if you were not with Washington, you were perceived to be against Washington. And despite the collapse of the Soviet Union in December 1991, that kind of thinking is still operative. That is to say, that if Greece is somehow able to embark on a policy of raising the minimum wage and improving working conditions and basically preserving a public sector and not privatizing the public sector, that is to say, not going down the path of the United States, where you have all these private universities and private hospitals and increasingly private roads and turnpikes that are benefiting private investors, charter schools, private schools as opposed to public schools, private water sources as opposed to public water sources, a hit on public transportation like subways, for example, and an enhancement of private transportation, private autos. So this is a basic conflict in the world today. And as a matter of fact, one of the problems that the oil industry, a major force in the political economy of capitalism, one of the problems that the oil industry faces is that companies like ExxonMobil, which is a private company, is finding it increasingly difficult to compete with publicly owned petroleum entities, such as the one in Venezuela. And that leads to conflict between Washington and Venezuela, an attempt to besmirch Venezuela, destabilize Venezuela, because ExxonMobil finds it difficult to compete with a competitor that does not have profit as its sole god. And that's part of what's at stake in Greece now. That is to say, will Greece, a small country of 11 million, be able to stand up against the privatizers, preserve its public sector, put people's needs above private benefit? And sadly enough, the answer to that question as we speak is unclear.
Well, just this week, President Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela is visiting Trinidad and Tobago. Trinidad and Tobago is significant because it is one of the largest oil refining nations in the world. Venezuela, one of the largest oil producing nations in the world. And this comes after the attempt by the United States to make its influence known in terms of energy alternatives in the Caribbean. And just today, in fact, I was reading the editorial, a New York Times editorial is featured today, and it says, of course, that President Maduro of Venezuela is basically conducting a purge of his enemies by arresting people who espouse different political views. The mayor, Antonio Ledezma of Caracas, was arrested and presumably charged with attempting to force a coup against the Maduro government. But we see the oil issue arising, and of course the New York Times has its own reasons for going after Maduro. I wonder first, would you have some thoughts about that? And secondly, to talk about the shift now, the oil shift in the Caribbean, and oil being part of the, a large part of the reason of renewed U.S. Intense interest in the Caribbean.
Well, the full court press is on Venezuela right now. I mean, the intensified pressure to destabilize the Maduro government is really mind-boggling right now. And sadly, what happens when countries are subjected to such intense pressure, like what Venezuela is experiencing as we speak, is that oftentimes it causes the leadership to stumble. It causes the leadership to make blunders, which, of course, is the purpose of the intensified pressure. It's like when a robber approaches you with a gun in hand to get your money, the purpose is to get your money, and the gun, they don't necessarily want to use the gun, but if you give up your money, well, then mission accomplished. And likewise, the pressure on Venezuela is in part designed to cause the regime to crumble. But even if the regime doesn't crumble, it's felt that the pressure will accomplish its goal if the regime makes mistakes that leads to blunders and errors. And unfortunately, it's not just Venezuela that's under attack right now. You see what's happening in Argentina, a close ally of Venezuela, with the allegation that the Fernandez Kirchner regime was involved in the assassination of a political prosecutor, Strike Political, who was supposedly going to bring charges against her for collaborating with the Iranians in helping the Iranians to escape an indictment for supposed involvement in a bombing of a Jewish community center in Buenos Aires some two decades ago. There have been thousands upon thousands marching in Buenos Aires against the president, who is not a friend of Washington. You know that relations between Brazil and the United States had been declining of late. Brazil is also a close ally of Venezuela. But what happened also has to do with oil. That is to say that Petrobras, which is a state-owned oil corporation, is now involved in scandal, which is weakening the regime of President Dilma Rousseff. And in fact, Dilma Rousseff, who had declined a state visit to Washington after revelations had come forth with regard to improper spying and espionage against her government by Washington, is now accepting an invitation to come to Washington. And then you mentioned the question of what's going on in the Caribbean, that is to say the subsidized oil that the Venezuelans had been able to produce for a number of poor Caribbean countries, including Haiti. And now with the Venezuelans under so much pressure, those kinds of subsidies are now under challenge. So it's not a very pretty picture, and I think that all has to be mentioned in the context of the only positive strand, which is not unconnected, which, of course, is the normalizing of relations with Cuba.
Well, Prime Minister Kamala Prasad Bisesar of Trinidad and Tobago has released a statement in which she says that the country reaffirms its commitment to bilateral cooperation on energy matters of interest to both countries. And I imagine that that means that the plan so far, which is to isolate Venezuela, has come into its first formidable, if you will, or notable resistance. But it may not be real resistance. It may be a pro forma resistance, but it is an expressed opinion just the same, and therefore significant. And so the issue of oil and how it's being manipulated around the world, just the same, hinges on the mighty petrodollar. In a way, are all these things, these oil-related things, basically linked to an effort by the U.S. to shore up the petrodollar?
Well, it's very curious about the fall in the price of oil, which as recently as a few months ago was at $100 a barrel, and now is hovering, say, between 50 and 60. Maybe a week or two ago it was down to 40, with some predicting it would go to 20. The idea then was that this was a kind of warfare that the Saudis and the United States were cooking up to weaken not only Venezuela, but also Iran and Russia, which are major oil producers and are all in the crosshairs of Washington in particular. But then other theories began to be floated. That is to say that the Saudis were actually aiming at the United States and its European allies, particularly Germany, which is in the fast lane, that is to say Germany, with regard to renewable energy. And it was felt that if the price of a barrel of oil fell dramatically, that would make the economics of renewable energy infeasible, speaking of solar, wind, etc. I'm not so sure about that theory, but it has a number of influential backers. I should also say that there's a kind of collateral damage domestically with regard to the fall in the price of oil. I'm speaking to you from the state of Texas, which, as you know, historically, at least for the past century, has been a major oil producer. And in Houston, which likes to bill itself as the energy capital of the United States, the fall of the price of oil has had dramatic financial and economic consequences, including layoffs, bankruptcies, increase in an already high rate of homelessness, and all the rest. And the Texas oil men are howling like stuck pigs about this fall in the price of oil, which, of course, leads to another kind of theory, which is that the Obama administration is going after its domestic antagonists, because, of course, Texas is the citadel of Republican Party conservatism, with two leading contenders for the GOP nod for president, Governor Rick DeHairdo Perry, just left office, and, of course, Senator Ted Wildman Cruz, the junior senator from Texas. And so Texas is really being hammered by the price of falling the price of a barrel of oil, and Venezuela and Russia are being hammered as well. Now, I don't necessarily give credence to that kind of theory, but listeners should know that that theory is floating around, at least in Houston.
So when you tie this all together, oil, the petrodollar, the Obama administration, are you seeing a kind of crafty, wily Obama as we've never seen him before?
Well, I will say this. I will say that our friends on the left need to recognize that in politics in a country like the United States, the ability to execute policies is heavily dependent upon the relationship of forces. And as already noted, if you look on the battlefield, the political battlefield in the United States, you see a very weak and feckless left-wing movement. I mean, look at the Republican Party right now. You see that Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, has been catapulted into the front ranks, just behind Jeb Bush, to get the GOP nod for president in 2016. And that's due in no small part to the fact that our friends in Wisconsin, particularly in Madison, which likes to style itself as a kind of Berkeley, were clamoring against Scott Walker, recall Scott Walker. They're going to put him in his place. And, of course, he squashed the recall and was able to raise money with the recall effort led by left-wing folk, and became a darling of conservatives. And obviously our left-wing friends, when they talked about recalling Walker, did not look at the relationship of forces, did not look at the fact that perhaps the working class in Wisconsin, at least the Euro-American working class and middle class, are not necessarily supportive of the recall. And so that's the kind of problem that we face in the United States of America. So future historians may make an argument that after the November 2014 election, where the Democrats got hammered, that it allowed for an inner Obama to emerge with regard to normalization of relations with Cuba, for example, the moves on immigration, for example, and that perhaps he had been hampered in inner councils of the Democratic Party by senatorial candidates such as in Kentucky against Mitch McConnell, who wouldn't even admit to voting for him. That is to say that the Democratic Party is not a very progressive instrument through which to effectuate change. And this is something that has to be taken into account. But I don't necessarily see a Wiley Obama emerging, that theory about oil prices notwithstanding. What I see is a strengthened right wing, strengthened on the basis of a low turnout November 2014 election, that's flexing its muscles, as evidenced by the fact that they may be on the verge of shutting down the entire government once again after doing the same thing just a few years ago, and probably will not be compelled to pay a price, which is very dangerous.
But we're not seeing, I mean, since we're bringing this home here, we're not seeing either a robust response from established progressive parties and organizations.
Oh, sure. Well, which progressive parties are you talking?
I mean, well, I was thinking like the Green Party and so forth.
Oh, I see. Well, let me look at Britain for example. People in the United States need to recognize that the left is weaker in the United States than any other leading capitalist country. I mean, in the elections in May 2015. In Britain, the Green Party is going to do very well. They may even wind up in a governing coalition with the Labour Party, believe it or not, heading a ministry in London, believe it or not. In Canada, you have the New Democratic Party, the NDP, a social democratic party that includes a number of leading socialists that's actually governed leading Canadian provinces and has a strong foothold in Vancouver, British Columbia. A very strong social democratic tendencies just north of New York City, just north of Boston and Montreal and Quebec. The same holds true for Japan. The same holds true for France, where you have a socialist of sorts in President Hollande. And what's striking about the United States, and what your grandchildren will ruminate about, and assuming that climate change and killer robots does not overcome us all, is why there's so little discourse and discussion about the comparative weakness of the United States of America. Instead, there's all this bravado. I mean, recall Scott Walker. You know, people act like this left is stronger than this. I think the left thinks that because they have the correct line, that means that they're destined to prevail. I guess that's the only thing I can come up with. What about you?
Well, I've been complaining a long time about the I think the just open contradictions of the left, specifically on the matters of race. I find the left to be very hypocritical about it and unwilling to engage in the discussion and to fix the problem squarely where it ought to be fixed, and that is that this is not a black issue. This is not for Latinos to correct. It is white America has got to engage, and whether they are from the right or the center or the left, they're not engaging in this necessary work. I've been carping about that for years.
Well, I should also mention that a pet peeve of mine is this term identity politics, I mean, which is ascribed to, say, a movement like Black Lives Matter arising out of the fiasco in Ferguson, Missouri. And that's oftentimes critiqued as being, quote, identity politics. And yet, this United States of America, as I tried to point out in my 1776 book, was organized on the basis of militarized identity politics, that is, say, the politics of whiteness. Now, how often do you hear the term identity politics affixed to whiteness, let alone white supremacy? I mean, that says it all there. But before our time expires, as we do this tour of the horizon, we would be remiss if we did not talk about the so-called Islamic State and the allied question of religious zealotry, which is not going away anytime soon, I'm afraid.
I'm hoping, not to cut you, but I'm hoping that you can come back and do a special program on this. We didn't have time today. Our time was cut short. But I really would like you, Gerald, to lay this out so we understand it, the way you do that.
Well, just briefly, because we're expiring at 1 o'clock, or excuse me, 2 o'clock, correct?
Actually, before in about a minute, we will be our time will be up. So this is why I'm asking if it's possible that you can take this on as a special assignment, if you will, if I could impose on you that way, and ask you to do a special presentation for us next time on ISIS. We really do need your insights into this.
Oh, absolutely! Just call me.
All right, you got it. And I want to thank you for today, also for being so gracious, though we started late. Thank you so much for your time today and giving us these wonderful insights into these complex problems that we're dealing with as
a world. Well,
thank
you for inviting me. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And that brings us to the end of our program today. I hope you found much of it to cause you to rethink what we have been told about these issues. And I always caution you that, you know, you want to be very careful about coverage, because many times the coverage has nothing to do with informing you, but actually planting other thoughts in your mind and shaping your attitudes so that you can be predictably managed. That's what propaganda is. So thank you so much for being with me today. Keep it right here on PRN.FM, and let me know what you're thinking. Write me at leadstories@gmail.com. That's the email. And on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Until then, tomorrow we continue with our labor, Blacks and Labor, Toil and Trouble, with Professor Charles Lumpkins. And until then, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.